And then I explained what a map between two categories was, namely a functor. And I got to the point of describing what a covariant and contravariant functor was. If you remember, so a map between two categories. And I said that if this category sets, the collection of either all covariant or contravariant functors is itself a category. And it's denoted like this. And for a particular choice of C, this will be the category that you use to describe quantum theory. In fact, it's a topos. I'll describe that later. Okay, so in details, what is this category? It has objects. So obviously objects are functors. And it has maps between objects, morphisms. Right. Which in this case they're called natural transformations. And they are maps between functors. So since functors are a little bit, they're not just simple objects, I have to describe them in details. So imagine you have a functor, and then another one. A natural transformation is a map between these two functors. Now, since what a functor does, it's to associate to each element a set. And this functor will associate to the same element a different set. So in order for this to be a well-defined map, it has to respect the fact that to the same object you're assigned two different sets. So it has to map these two guys to each other. So what this means, this is really odd. So what this means is that for each object in your category, you get local components. So for all objects in your base category, you get local components of your natural transformation. Okay, not only that, since these are categories, you have morphisms, right? So you have maps in this category. And you know that this functor associates to this map, a map here. Well, this functor associates the same map, another map in here. Okay. So in order for this to be a well-defined natural transformation, so in order for this to map the image that this functor gives to this category to the image this functor gives to the same category, it also has to map these two functions one to each other. So what this means is the following. So you have the natural component for B. And so the condition of mapping this to this simply means that this diagram commutes. Now here I'm just considering covariant functors. If you had contravariant functors, these guys would go the other way around. But it's the same thing, right? What these natural transformations do, they map this map, they map it to this map here. So natural transformations really map the image given from this functor to this category to the image given by this functor to the same category, such that these kind of things commute. I mean, this is a little complicated, but really all you have is objects and maps between objects, but these maps are a little more involved simply because the objects are not simple, but they're maps themselves. But it's still a collection of maps and objects. Okay, now this category will be the category in which we'll write quantum theory for a particular choice of a base category. Now I'll describe what this base category is, then I'll justify the choice of it, and then I'll give an example. Okay, so what is this base category? So in order to write quantum theory, the choice of this base category is the following. This is the category, of abelian von Neumann, I think you spell it like that, I'm not sure, subalgebras of the algebra of bounded operators. So the algebra of bounded operators, just write it like this. For now, don't worry about what this is. I'll explain it later. Right. Just for now, just think of it as the collection of all abelian subalgebras of the algebra of bounded operators. So this is the category. So obviously we've got objects, and these are abelian algebras, and it has maps between the objects, and these maps are defined by inclusion. So given two algebras, there exists a map between them if the domain is a subalgebra of the codomain. So what this category really is a partially ordered set. So it's a set of physical elements. It's ordered because given any two elements, since the ordering is given by inclusion, you can have at most one arrow, really. You can't have more than one. And it's partially ordered because it can be the case that two algebras are totally disjoint, so there is no inclusion. But if there is a map, then there is unique, because it's inclusion. So that's the definition of a partially ordered set. So this category here will be the category, the base category. So the category which we'll use to describe quantum theory will be this one. So the collection of all contravariant functors from the abelian subalgebras to sets. Okay, now why did we choose this category? And the reason is the following. So as I said in the first lecture, the aim of using topos theory to rewrite quantum theory is to render quantum theory more realist in some way. Now, the funny stuff of quantum theory really comes from the fact that in the collection of all operators, there are certain operators that don't commute. That is a specific feature of quantum theory. You don't have it in classical theory. Now, the idea is that if you consider abelian subalgebras, then everything commutes there. So in terms of this abelian subalgebras, you have a chance to make your theory more classical. So the idea is to consider the classical snapshots, if you want to call them, and define all your objects in quantum theory locally in terms of these classical snapshots. So locally you have a kind of classical description of your theory, but we're not cheating, right? Because the collection of all this local classical snapshots forms the category, which means that you can put the total information back in the picture from the categorical structure. So the full quantum theory is given by a collection of classical snapshots, so to say. And the quantum picture is put back in by the categorical structure of your collection of all abelian monomers about you. So that's the motivation. Have a theory which locally can be described in a quasi-classical way, but globally you get the full quantum picture. It'll be a bit clear when I actually define the object, but that's the reason why this category was chosen. Because for each classical snapshot, you get an element. So this functor is like a collection of loads of different classical snapshots. That's the kind of idea. Okay, so what is an abelian monomers of algebra? I'm not going to give the technical definition, I'll just give an example. I'll actually construct one, which I think is easier to understand. And the definition is in the lecture notes, so you can just find it. Okay. So okay, let's consider a four-dimensional Hilbert space. Now, the algebra of bounded operators is simply the collection of all 4x4 matrices with complex entries. Right. That's simple. Okay, now in order to define an abelian monomers of algebra, the first thing to do is to choose a basis. So just choose one. Okay. Then to this basis, you associate a set of projection operators which project on the one-dimensional subspace defined by this, each of the elements of the basis. So this would project on this guy. This would project on this. Oops. This guy. This would project on this guy, and so on, right? Now, given a basis and given a set of projection operators, then you can define two types of von Neumann algebras. You have a maximum von Neumann algebra, which is an algebra which is not contained in any other algebra, and you have non-maximal ones. And a maximum von Neumann algebra is defined as follows, as the linear complex combination of all the elements of, well, all the projection operators associated to your basis. So is this. I'll write some matrices down in a second, but this is the definition. Right. So this is what a maximum von Neumann subalgebra is. So if you have like this basis, then your projection operators would be the following. One here, zero. Zero, zero, zero. One, zero everywhere. One. All right. And the last one would be zero everywhere and one here. Then what this is would be simply all 4x4 diagonal matrices with complex entries. Right. So since you sum them all up, this, you get the diagonal matrices, and then you'll have complex entries, because you multiply a complex number, and the collection of all of them is a maximum abelian polynomials of algebra. It's quite simple, really. Obviously, this is for one choice of basis, right? If I change my basis, then I would get a different abelian maximum, abelian polynomials of algebra. If they're related by phase factor, no, you get the same. But if they're not, then you get a distinct one. In fact, you get uncountably many of maximal ones. However, you also have non-maximal ones, and these are the following. For our cases, there are only two types. I mean, because we're just in four dimensions, you only have two types of non-maximum abelian polynomials of algebras, and these are the following. One is by leaving two projection operators free. So you get this. You leave two free and you sum the other two. So this again is this guy. This is a subalgebra of this, right? Yeah.
Trees, I mean, is it possible?
Yeah. I mean, you also have the collection of all. You have the zero operator, you have the identity, you have the individual ones. Is that what I mean?
That's okay.
And then leaving one projection operator free, and you get this. And these are really the only two types of subalgebras for a given maximum abelian subalgebra. However, it can be the case that two maximum abelian subalgebras have some other subalgebra in common. So for example, if you chose a basis such that you get this projection operators, so you have this one in common with this one, then the maximum abelian subalgebra related to that choice of basis would be the following. And you can see that it has this in common with this guy. So the algebra which they would share would be the one that has P1 as the free projection operator. So it would be this one. So you can obviously write them in both ways. But this is actually equivalent to this. Right. Since this is an algebra which contains two free projection operators. Since it's an algebra, it has to contain the projection operator and its complement. So this in reality is simply the complement of this projection operator. And the same is true for here. So this is just this. So they're actually the same algebras. And these are shared by two maximal abelian polynomials of algebras. So this is all very lengthy, but just to show how this category is defined. So it has as object this abelian polynomials of algebras, which are constructed like complex linear combination of certain sets of orthogonal projection operators, and it has as maps inclusion. So a graphical representation of it is as follows. So I'm not going to consider all of them since I'm countably many, but if we consider the basis, this basis here, with this maximum of Jensen algebra, then the graphical representation of this category is as follows. So you have your maximum algebra. Then you consider the first set of subalgebras, which are these guys, and you get five of them. You get these guys. And these are all subalgebras of this guy, so you get an arrow between them. Okay, that's getting messy. Then the other subalgebras, the smallest ones, are the ones that have one free projection operator, and there are four of them. And these depend, as you can see from how they're constructed, will be subalgebras of the algebras which have the same free projection operator. Yeah? So this will be subalgebra of that, of that, of that. This will be subalgebra of this, of this. This will be, okay, it gets messy, but down here. And this will be that. And then there's the trivial algebra, which is the identity, which is subalgebra of everything. So this is for only one von Neumann subalgebra. This is how this category looks like. This arrow is subset inclusion. And now if you had another maximum abelian subalgebra, this guy here, oh, double prime, then we've seen that it had this algebra in common. So you would get an arrow from here to here, and so on and so forth. So this is to show that eventually when we write quantum theory in terms of individual classical snapshots, the full quantum picture is put back by this set of relations, by the categorical structure of the collection of all this Abelian von Neumann subalgebras. So it's like a collection of classical snapshots. Okay, now, I said that the category we're going to use will be the category formed by the collection of all contravariant functors from the category of Abelian von Neumann subalgebras to sets.
The number of von Neumann algebras for a finite dimensional space is counted with time. What did you just mention? Is it for C4 only, or?
Oh, in general.
In general, is
it? Yeah. Uncountable, yeah. Well, you have one for any. Okay, maybe for C4 it might not be, but you have one for each choice of basis.
Okay.
You've got the maximal one, and then you've got all.
What about infinite dimensional situation, like a Bolan space?
Well, then, yeah, you would get much more, yeah. Less.
Sorry? Less or?
No, you get less, smaller set, less.
Okay.
In general, yeah, okay. Yeah, you'd get this. Okay, so this will be the category and the topos which we will use to write quantum theory. So, what is a topos? So it is a category, so it has objects and it has relations. However, it's a very special type of category since it has a lot of internal structure which enables you to define pretty much any mathematical operation that you would like to define. So what this means is that the internal structure of a topos makes it look like sets, in the sense that anything that you can do in set theory has a topos analog. So in a topos, you can define a Cartesian product. That's not true for general category. In a topos, you can define disjoint union. That's not true for general category. So the special properties of topos theory is that you can just consider it as a general version of sets. Now, I won't give the axiomatic definition of what a topos is, since it requires telling you all this internal structure, which is going to take too long, is a little complicated. But the important thing is to understand that this internal structure enables you to consider topos like sets, a generalized version of it. So anything you can do in set theory, you can do in a topos. Now, of particular importance is the existence of the truth object or sub-object classifier. Now, in sets, we saw it was just true or false. In a topos, you have many more elements. Now, what the elements are will depend on what your topos is, and in the next lecture, I'll give an example for this topos here. But for now, just think that you have a lot of elements, not just true or false. I mean, the extreme points are the classical analogs of true or false, but you have a lot of stuff in between. And what this means is the following. So if you have an object in your topos, and you have your truth object, and you consider a sub-object, A, and you ask the question, is A a sub-object of S? And the answer is yes. That would also be the classical answer. However, in a general topos, you can also ask this question, is B a sub-object of S? Classical theory, you couldn't really ask it. In topos, you can, and you get a well-defined answer, so you get something in between. And I told you that if you have another object that is just a tiny bit a sub-object, and you ask a C a sub-object of S, then you get an answer which is less than the question that you asked for B. So in a general topos, you have a well-defined mathematical notion of what it means to nearly be a sub-object of something, and how far off you are to being a sub-object of something. So obviously, these elements are ordered, so you can compare them. So you know the difference between asking the question, is B a sub-object of S, or is C a sub-object of S. So, I mean, this is what you get when you have a multivalued logic. And this, obviously, if it isn't, then you get false, right? So you still get the classical analogs, but you get also stuff in between. So you get a multivalued logic. Then the second element that is common both to topos and sets is the existence of an internal logic. In set theory, you know that the collection of all subsets forms a Boolean algebra. In a topos, the collection of all subobjects forms a Hating algebra. And this is basically a generalized version of a Boolean algebra. It is distributive, the only real difference with a Boolean algebra is that it does not have the law of excluded middle. So, what is the law of excluded middle? So imagine you have a set, or an object, in your topos, then you consider the negation of that object, then you consider the or, that doesn't give you back unity, it gives you something smaller. So in set theory, you have the set, union, the complement, that gives you back the entire thing. In Hating algebra, that's not true, you get something smaller. So an example of a Hating algebra, which I think everyone's familiar with, is the collection of all open subsets in a topological space. That's actually a Hating algebra. fact, if you have an open set, then you consider the complement that's closed. So in order to still be in the set of all open sets, you get the interior. If you join them, then you don't get back the same thing. Right? You're missing the boundary. So the collection of all open sets in a topological space, that's a Hessian algebra. So it's pretty much, you can consider Hessian algebra pretty much like a Boolean logic algebra for all practical purposes. The only difference that in a Hessian algebra, you can't prove things by contradiction, precisely because of that. But you can do everything else. Okay, so this is a very general definition of what a topos is. In the lecture notes is much more detailed, but for our purpose of the lecture, you just need to know that topos is a category. This has objects and relations, and it has a lot of internal structure which enables you to consider it as sets, so everything that you can do in set theory as a topos analog. And the importance is the existence of the subobject classifier, which gives you a multivalued logic, and the internal logic, which is a Hessian algebra, which is the multivalued logic. This is all that you really need to know about topos. Now, the beauty of topos theory, differently from category theory, is as soon as you have a topos, you already know what type of maps you're going to use. So in a general category, you don't have associated with it an internal algebra. But in a topos, you do. So that is the, well, that's the beauty of topos theory. You immediately have an internal language to use. Okay, so now I explained roughly what a topos is. Now the next step is trying to represent the abstract language in this topos for quantum theory. We did that for classical theory in sets. Now we're going to do the same for quantum theory in that general topos. So the first thing that we're going to represent is a state space. So in natural language, the state space was a term of type sigma. Now we want to represent this as an object in this topos. So it has to be a contravariant functor, right? If it has to belong to the topos. So it has to be a map from your abelian binomials of algebras to sets. So what does this map do? It associates to each algebra the spectrum of the algebra. So by spectrum I mean all linear multiplicative functionals from the algebras to the complex numbers, which give value 1 to the identity operator. To each algebra it associates a spectrum. And not only that, to each morphism, well, there's a morphism, is this is a subalgebra of that, it associates a map between the respective spectrum. Being a contravariant functor, the map goes the other way around. So can you close the door? Sorry. Thank you. It's kind of an annoying sound. Oh, that's better. Thanks. So it's a map from the two spectrum going the other way around. So it's a map from the spectrum of the big algebra to the spectrum of the small algebra. And this map is given by restriction. So each element of the spectrum simply gets restricted to the subalgebra. And this is... Now, it'll come clear why this is, but this is the topos analog of your state space. Now, I'll just draw it here. So, you have here your category of Abelian subalgebras. Well, part of it, anyway. This is your elements. Then the state space that functor associates to each of the algebra, it associates its spectrum. Right. Such that if you have an arrow here, so this is the algebra of that, there is a corresponding arrow up here in terms of the spectra, which is defined in terms of restriction. So this is, from this picture, you see what I mean by classical snapshots. Now, for each algebra, this thing here can be considered as a local classical state space. I mean, as a topology and everything, this you can actually consider it as a classical state space. And this is true for each context. For each context, you get the spectrum of this algebra, and it can be thought of as a local classical state space. However, the full quantum state space is all of this taken together. There's a collection of classical snapshots. The quantum picture is put back in by the fact that you consider all of them and by the fact that you have relations and maps. So it's kind of put intertwined, the quantum information intertwined back in it. But you can really consider them as classical snapshots. Okay, now let's give an example of this thing. So let's still do it for the four-dimensional Hilbert space. Now again, we consider this basis, right? So what I just rubbed off, we're going to consider this basis. All right, so four-dimensional Hilbert space. What is the state space? Okay, we first consider our maximum abelian subalgebra, which was this. Right. Now, what's the spectrum of this algebra? Now, this algebra has really only four free operators. And being projection operators, they can either have value 1 or value 0. So the spectrum of this algebra is really composed of four elements. The ones that give value 1 to projection operator 1 and 0 to all the rest. Gives 1 to this, 0 to all the rest, and so on and so forth. There's this. So up here, you have four elements. Now we'll go to a subalgebra. Let's consider a subalgebra with two free operators, P1 and P2. This is this guy. This has three free projection operators. So the spectrum is comprised of three elements. The ones that this gives 1 to this, 0 to all the rest. This gives 1 to this, 0 to all the rest. And this gives value to this, 1 to this, and 0 to all the rest. So here you have three elements. Now, because it's a subalgebra of that, you need to define a map between these two guys. So you need to define a map from here to here. So how do you do this? You first consider this element, and you know that it gives value 1 to P1. Now, this algebra has P1 in it, so this element will be mapped to the unique element, which gives value 1 to P1. So you get this. Not easy. For lambda 2, this gives value 1 to P2 and 0 to all the rest. P2 is still in here, so this gets mapped to the unique element that gives value 1 to P2 and 0 to all the rest. So let's get some maps for this guy. Now lambda 3. This gives value to P3, 0 to all the rest. Now there isn't P3 in here, but there is something that is more general. So this projection operator is implied by P3. So if you were to act with this on this guy, it would give 1. So this map here has to be mapped to the unique element in this spectrum, which gives value 1 to this generalized projection operator. And it's lambda 3 prime. Right? So this goes here. And you can understand what happens to P4 is the same thing. This gives value 1 to this guy. This is a generalized projection operator of this, so this gets associated to the unique element which gives value to this generalized projection operator, and that's again lambda 3 prime. So you get that. Now if you go to a smaller context, let's say you go to the one that has only P1 free, then this has only 2 free operators, so we'll only have 2 elements in its spectrum. Number 4. Gives value 1, 0 everything, gives value 1, 0 to everything else. Now imagine you want to define a map between this 2 spectra. And again, this gives value 1 to P1, P1 is in here, so this gets mapped the unique one that gives value 1 to P1. Right. So, like this. And, I mean, you can understand how this goes, right? Lambda 2 prime and lambda 3 prime will get mapped to this element, which gives value 1 to the generalized projection operator, which is implied by both this one and this one. And so on and so forth. So for each context, you do the same and you can define the maps. And this is really the analog of your quantum state space if this is the mathematical universe you're considering. And again, it's simply a collection of classical snapshots where the full picture is put back by all these relations. Okay, now the last thing I'll do is the concept of a proposition. So that was a state space. Now what's a proposition? Now in the abstract language, a proposition was identified with a term of type P sigma. So a subobject of the state space. This is your state space. We need to define a subobject of this. So you need the concept of a subfunctor. So what's a subfunctor? This is your state space functor. Leave a little bit more space. Now, a subfunctor maps to each element a subset of the set associated to the functor which it's a subfunctor of. Of each element is associated subset in such a way that the maps of the functor are simply restricted to the subset, and these restricted maps are the maps of your subfunctor. So it's still a subfunctor is still a functor from your category to sets, but the set it associates to will be subset of the functor of which it is subfunctor of. Is that kind of clear? So what's a proposition? A proposition has to be a subfunctor of your state space. So again, the propositions that we're concerned of in physics are of this type. The quantity A has a value in a certain range. In standard quantum theory, this is associated with a projection operator. But somehow we need to define this projection operator as a functor from this category to set. So somehow you have to localize for each element of this category the representative of this proposition. So how do you do that? So let's go here to this picture again. So what we're trying to do is define locally this proposition for each context. So we go to this algebra. Let's say the projection operator belongs to that algebra. Then what you do is up here in your state, local state space, you pick out all the elements. You pick out all the elements of the spectrum of that algebra, which give value 1 to your proposition. This is a subset of this set here. Then you go to another algebra. Let's say that this time your projection operator doesn't belong to this algebra. So what you do, you generalize your projection operator so as to belong to this algebra. So you pick out the smallest projection operator which belongs to that algebra and which is implied by your original projection operator. There's the smallest projection operator which is in here and which is bigger than P. So you coarse grain your proposition, you make it more general, and you go up here and you pick out all the elements of your spectrum which now give value 1 to this generalized proposition. And you do that for each context. So for each context, the local representative of your proposition will be a general projection operator which is implied by a proposition and which belongs to that context. And then at the level of the spectrum, you pick out the subset which gives value 1 to your generalized local proposition.
Bigger than B.
Oh, well, that's if it projects on a bigger subspace.
Okay.
Space. I mean, it could be the case that in some algebras you have to generalize it so much that you get the identity operator. That could be the case. But that doesn't matter. The important is that for each context, you get a local version of your proposition. And for that local version, you pick out the elements in the spectrum which give value 1 to your local proposition. You put everything together with all the relations, etc., and you get your global version of a proposition, which is a resheaf from your context category to sets. And what this resheaf does, it assigns to each algebra a subset of the spectrum of that algebra, which gives value 1 to the local representative of the proposition for that context. And as a global definition of a proposition. And this is a sub-functor of this guy. You can see it from the drawing. So again, even in describing a proposition, you see how everything is defined locally, and the collection of all these local, classical snapshots gives you the quantum picture. Now I'll stop here, because it's kind of time's up. But in the next lecture, I'll give an example of this guy in 4 dimensions in the same 4-dimensional Hilbert space, and then I'll define what a truth object is, and then I'll finally show how to give values to propositions which are in one-to-one correspondence with probability. But for now, I'll stop. Thanks.